Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, September 11th, 1995. In the Creekside room this morning, our speaker is Evelyn Strang, and she will be speaking on Celebrating the Creation, Origin Stories Shape Us. Let's listen in.
This series proposed for this week is called Celebrating the Creation, with different subheadings. And I need to define the way I'm using creation. Sometimes you hear it used in an adversarial way in terms of creation versus evolution. That is not what we're doing here. At least I'm not. You may want to get into it if you want to. But I'm looking at the natural world, the cosmos, if you wish, as God's creation. The whole natural world and our relationship to it, and trying to gain particularly some biblical perspectives on it. Now, we're all aware of environmental issues. I mean, whether it's spotted owls in the Northwest and loggers, or whether it's water resources in our part of the country, or whatever it is, environmental issues are very, very upfront. Does Scripture have anything that would serve as a guideline in some of these? And so these are some of the kinds of things we will be getting into. We will be using Bibles more extensively throughout the week. I also realize that people come and go, and on gorgeous mornings like this is a good time to be hiking, whatever. So each session will be rather independent. But today's session has been suggested as dealing with origins and origin stories. And immediately we think of Genesis and Bible study. And we'll get into that shortly. But probably every group of people has some kind of an origin story. And I thought I would like to share a few with you, creation stories, if you wish. A wonderful one from Walter Wangren. Do you know Walter Wangren?
Oh,
you
yes.
Must have. Marvelous storyteller. And his book, which he says is his best, where he really put himself into it, is his A Crying for a Vision. It's in the bookstore. And it is very much dealing with Native American aspects. Come on in, hi. And so in Walter Wangren's A Crying for a Vision, he has a wonderful origin story, a Lakota story of the beginnings of the earth. May I share that with you from Walter Wangren? In the beginning, all the world was only water. There was nothing but water everywhere. But Wankantanka needed some mud for making an earth. Wankantanka, he says, is the all-embracing term for deity, for God. So Wankantanka. So needed some mud for making an earth. So whom could he send to get it for him? Who could swim so long and strong that he might go even to the bottom of the sea and bring up a little mud? Well, Turtle could. We know this because we have seen what a strong heart Turtle has. Even when you take the heart out of his body, it keeps on beating, and it does not stop beating for several days. Turtle has great endurance. Yes, Turtle could swim to the bottom of the first sea. So Turtle swam down beneath the waves. He was gone for 7 lifetimes. He may not be fast, but Turtle is very faithful, and finally he poked his head out of the water right in front of Wankantanka, the deity. Where was the mud? Well, Turtle has strong jaws. If he bites you, he might never open his mouth again, not even if you kill him. You have to cut that bite apart. But Turtle loved Wankantanka. He was glad to obey the Creator. So he opened his mouth, and inside there was a perfect ball of beautiful mud. So Wankantanka made the earth, lovely and sweet and green. Then he thought about all the peoples who were going to live on this earth, the four-leggeds, the two-leggeds, and those with wings, and he loved them. He loved them very much. He did not want his creatures to suffer. But what if the waters tried to cover this new earth as once they covered everything else? So Wankantanka needed someone to guard the earth from the water. Who could stand at the farthest shore and protect all the peoples who breathe air? Well, Tatanka could, buffalo, mightier than most and more honorable even than those who are stronger than he. Buffalo could. So Wankatanka commanded one great buffalo to stand watch between the infinite water and Maka, the beautiful earth that he had made. Buffalo is still there, even down to this very day. But we know of time and toil and tiredness. We know what time does to all things. We have seen wrinkles in old faces, and gullies in old soil, and canyons in the ancient mountains. And we have felt weariness in our own bones. And we know too, yes, we know very well, the destruction some people commit and other people suffer. Therefore, this is a truth we do not ignore, that the story of Buffalo guarding the earth has an end. For every year that he has stood at the edge of the everlasting sea, Tatanka has lost one hair. And for every age that has passed since he began, he has lost one leg. There are four legs for every buffalo born. There are four ages granted unto this world. Four. When finally Tatanka is bald and his fourth leg breaks, then shall come the end in flood. The rolling blue waters shall return to cover again this mouthful of mud, the earth. So when times are very bad, we have a saying among ourselves. This would be the Lakota Native Americans. And all our relatives understand what we mean when we say it. We shake our heads. We lower our faces and shake our heads and whisper, "He is on his last leg." And then they also bow their heads in sadness. "Yes," they say, "it is obvious. He is on his last leg now." Now, there's a charming origin story as told by Walter Wangren, authentically derived from the Lakota people, about origins. Does it say anything about the relationship of the Creator and the creation?
Yes. He loved it.
What did you hear in that?
He loved his creation.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting... Just people?
No.
Yeah, yeah. The four-legged, the ones that fly. And it's a beautiful story. There are many others like that. Let me just choose one or two more. This is one that is supposed to come out of the Polynesian people in the middle of the Pacific. And this is their story of creation by God called Ta'aroa. He existed. Ta'aroa was his name. In the immensity, there was no sea. There was no man. Above, Ta'aroa calls. Existing alone, he became the universe. Ta'aroa is the origin, the rocks. Ta'aroa is the sands. It is thus that he is named. Ta'aroa is the light. Ta'aroa is within. Ta'aroa is the germ. Ta'aroa is beneath. Ta'aroa is firm. Ta'aroa is wise. He created the land of Hawaii. Hawaii, the great and sacred, as the body or shell for Ta'aroa. What is that saying, in a way?
He created everywhere. In everything.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And maybe one more, part of one more. This is from the Hindu version. Now there's one from the Shinto. There are different ones. But the one who rules over every single source, in whom this whole world comes together and dissolves, the Lord, the blessing giver, God adorable, by revering him, one goes forever to his peace. I won't read all of it, but by knowing as kindly him who is hidden in all things, exceedingly fine, like the cream that is finer than butter, the one embracer of the universe, by knowing God, one is released from all fetters. His form is not to be beheld. No one soever sees him with the eye. They who thus know him with heart and mind, as abiding in the heart, become immortal. Some interesting concepts. Well, the study of comparative religion, which some of you know much more about than I do, I'm sure, shows that most groups have some kind of an origin story. And if you were in the Bible study this morning with Merle Frankie, you heard a marvelous background for understanding Scripture properly in terms of what is the intent of Scripture in the background. The idea that when we have stories in Scripture, here's some more Bibles, when we have stories in Scripture, they are meant to make a point, as Jesus' parables were meant to be make a point. Was there actually a person who got clobbered on the road from Jerusalem to Jericho just that way, or was it the story to make a point, the idea? And so when we come out of an oral tradition to a written tradition over many thousands of years, the stories remain, which say something. Now, again, I know there are clergy here. I am not. I have not had the Greek, the Hebrew, which would be, of course, for the Genesis text, or whatever. So I'm counting on you to fill me in on anything like this. But I'm sure most of us have read that this particular story in Genesis 1, the beginning, is not necessarily entirely original with the Hebrew people. If you look in your Anchor Bible, and I'm sure there's an Anchor Bible here, I'm just taking a comparison here by an editor there, and a fine introduction showing old Babylonian texts. And I'm sure anybody who went to seminary had this someplace, didn't you all? At seminary, that the Babylonian texts, which predate anything we know of the Hebrew people in Scripture, their older texts talk about the primeval chaos. All right, if you look at Genesis 1, you know, in the beginning, the idea that there was a chaos, darkness covering the deep. That idea is in the Babylonian text. I haven't read it. I'm doing secondary information from what I've read in references. That light was created. If you look at your Genesis story, blessings. What is the first thing? What is the first thing that is created as you look in Genesis 1? You have light. And that's the same way in the Babylonian text. In the Babylonian text, light is emanating from the gods, but light is created. What's the next thing created? Bless you. Firmament. All right. And that follows the Babylonian text. And then the dry land, right? Luminaries. The creation of humankind comes after all of this. In the Babylonian text, the gods rest and celebrate. God rests and sanctifies the seventh day. That idea of this story of creation is also seen in other sources. Somewhere there must be beginnings. Now, there are definitely differences. Bless you. And the Hebrew scriptures, Genesis, differ from the Babylonian texts in that we do not have gods, many gods, and in fact the references say that in the Babylonian texts there's a succession of various rival deities. While in Genesis we have one God, monotheism, which I think is very, very clear. So in that sense, that we have one God. But there are also a few other little differences. And someone was quoting C.S. Lewis this morning. C.S. Lewis is again being heard about. There's a new biography of him that was just reviewed in last week's Christian Century, for example. And maybe some of you saw the movie Shadowlands. So it's interesting. We have not forgotten C.S. Lewis, even though he's been gone for a number of years. C.S. Lewis is making this distinction between God and nature. Now, I think we've seen in all of the illustrations from the different religions. I mean, the nature as we know it, a relationship to God, some kind of a relationship. What is that relationship? In the Polynesian thing, the earth, you might say, the physical environment is sort of a shell in which the Creator may be encountered. So you have different versions of how closely the deity is actually part of the creation, or is the deity separate from the creation. C.S. Lewis helps us by saying this: to say that God created nature, while it brings God and nature into relation, also separates them. What makes and is made must be two, not one. Thus, the doctrine of creation in one sense empties nature of divinity. Now, that's very clear when you look at some of the Psalms, for example. When I consider the heavens, the moon, and the stars, which thou hast ordained, which thou hast made. It's not worshiping the creation, but it's seeing the Creator beyond. That's very clear throughout Hebrew scriptures, that the creation is not to be worshipped. But then C.S. Lewis says, the author of Job knew that if he had kissed his hand to the moon, it would have been iniquity. I mean, the idea that worship the moon, that would be considered iniquity. Yet, in another sense, the same doctrine which empties nature of her divinity also makes her an index, a symbol, a manifestation, that word preachers used to like, manifestation, a showing forth of the divine, so that the interpretation of the Genesis story, the idea that you have the creation, and yet the Creator is separate from that, but that the nature, the creation, shows forth the Creator. Now, there's one perspective, I think, and stop me anytime you have a comment here. There's one perspective that I think is very, very important, giving away all the Bibles, but thank you. But if you look in Genesis 1, which we should do for a minute, I'd have to share. Now, the sequence and so on, I'm not worrying about. The point that is made, what is God, seems to be God's perspective as by the biblical writer on this creation. And we start really getting into this in verse 10, when things are sort of getting shaped up. The end of verse 10 says what?
And God saw that it was good.
All right. And then we get into plants and things. And the end of verse 12 says what?
God saw that it was good.
All right, and then we get the luminaries and so on, and the idea of light and darkness and whatnot, serving sun, moon, and stars in a regular fashion. You can explain this scientifically in terms of rotation of the earth being established. You know, we used to try to justify this. I've done some of that, but that, I don't think that's the point here. The viewpoint given in the end of verse 18 is what?
God saw that it was good.
All right, and then come all these creatures, things in the oceans, and the end of verse 21 says what?
God saw that it was good.
All right, and then we've got some more creatures on the land, and the end of verse 25 is what?
God saw that it was good.
All right, and so we have the whole thing. We have sort of a summary of all of this story, of the creation story. And the summary in verse 31 says what?
God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good.
Very good, right. The perspective on creation here, on the natural world, is here something very special. Here we go. This is a little card. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and saw how good it was, which is the idea of here, the perspective that this was. Now, you know, there's more than one creation story. I won't get into that in particular. Now, there is one little verse that has probably caused more problems than any other. And that is going back to verse 26 in Genesis 1. And I don't know what translations, whether all of these are RSV or not, depending on different translations. But what does yours read in verse 26? Someone have it?
And God said, "Let us make man in our own image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth."
All right. Now, of course, in verse 27, now we could go into the whole business of what is the image of God. And you notice that in the image of God created he him, male and female, he created them. I was not going to get into that, but the first part of verse 26, that idea of having, let them have dominion, the relationship of human beings to the environment. Well, about 1970 is when the environmental movement really started, when the, one would say, when the fat hit the fan, and whatever the expression is, when a lot of the groups that became very environmentally conscious really came into action, because this is when air pollution was getting pretty bad. Rivers were being fouled pretty much. We were discovering all kinds of problems in the environment. And the April 22nd, 1970 was the first national environmental teach-in. Now, April 22nd is still Earth Day, right? But it started in 1970. And one of the seminal articles that made a lot of people think was one by Lynn White Jr. I read it originally in Science, the association, the publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, of which I used to be a member. Anyway, this article has been widely quoted. It is still referred to. And Lynn White Jr., in this article, was called "The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis." Okay. First of all, it was recognizing that there were some problems with people, nature, environment, right? We all learned the word ecology in those days. And whether or not you think any problem now, most people, you still read about environmental problems. I think I'm of the conviction there are some problems in how this creation meant to be good has been despoiled and misused and so on. I mean, now you may disagree with that, but I think it's not all as good as the Creator's intention apparently was. And Lynn White is saying, what people do about their ecology depends on what they think about themselves in relation to things around them. Human ecology is deeply conditioned by beliefs about our nature and destiny, that is, by religion. And then he went on to say that what did Christianity tell people about their relations with the environment? Especially in its Western form, Christianity is the most anthropocentric religion the world has seen. By destroying pagan animism, Christianity made it possible to exploit nature in a mood of indifference to the feelings of natural objects, and so on. And he's saying, we are superior to nature, contemptuous of it, willing to use it for our slightest whim. What we do about ecology depends on our ideas of the man, nature, I would say human nature relationship, the relationship of people to the creation. Does our understanding of origins, the Creator's, what is expressed as the Creator's intentions, and also does our religion inform us about what we do about the environment? I would like to develop that throughout the week, and for those of you who will not be able to be here all times, I have some background on that, text references. However, to illustrate further, at Holden Village right now, we have Sierra Club members from all over the country who are doing hiking throughout, and so you may see some of the hikers who will be out. I will admit that I am a Sierra Club member. I have not always agreed with everything they do in local areas, but anyway, I'm a member. And usually they have a page of opinion in the Sierra magazine about a particular subject. And one 2 years ago was, has organized religion benefited or harmed the planet? And these were random opinions from people throughout the country. While organized religion has its merits, it seems to restrict spirituality to a building or a gathering of people. Maybe if we as individuals spent more time listening to the earth, we could widen our focus to understand and love all of creation, not just the human aspect. That's someone from Pennsylvania. Here's someone from Kansas City. Having created God in man's own image, Western religion has adopted an anthropocentric mythology that separates God from creation, soul from body, and man from earth. It is this dualism that prevents us from relating not only to the natural world, but to ourselves. It is ironic that Christian missionaries have spent the last 2,000 years converting pagan indigenous peoples whose traditional beliefs, for the most part, encompassed a holistic, naturalistic mythology that taught respect for earth and for all life. Now, you may get a little angry at some of these things, but I mean, these are opinions that people had about in response to this question. Here's a rather ironic one from Arizona. Organized religion has benefited the planet by eradicating millions of lives in wars of hate and racial cleansing. We talked about that this morning in terms of ethnic cleansing still going on and so on, and some of it in the name of religion. Well, and here's another viewpoint from San Antonio, Texas. Given the environmental and moral disasters created in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, one could say that organized atheism has caused the greater harm to the planet and to the human spirit. There is a point to that. Anyway, all right, does it make any difference how one sees the natural world in terms of whether it is something to be used or whether it is something just for the benefit of humanity, what kind of relationship? I am basically, I guess, more of a geographer than anything. This is from the Annals of the Association of American Geographers, which most of the articles I don't understand because they get pretty technical. But the title is Human Domination Over Nature in the Hebrew Bible. And this geographer is saying, in this high-level professional magazine, the implications of the biblical view of human domination over nature are troublesome for intellectual history, modern conservation, and allied divisions of geography. The Genesis commandment for humanity to subjugate nature turns out to depend on integrity and moral fitness rather than economic activities and so on. But then she says, the Bible nevertheless cannot be disregarded as a likely source of contemporary environmental ethics. and goes on with this, which is interesting from a geography magazine. Religion, like geography, is after all of investigating human's place in the natural world and of determining causality, order, and eventual outcomes. A strong grounding in our culture's basic religious texts seems a reasonable place to begin in environmental studies, which is sort of interesting coming out way outside the church anyplace.
Well, one of the problems here is that they're judging God by humans, how humans behave, and this is the wrong way to approach that.
So what is the understanding here that will help us in terms of looking at the accusations that have been made? I mean, can we look at Scripture again and gain a better understanding of what it really says? Let's go back to that verse on having dominion. I'm sure many of you have read things about that and have discussed it, and much has been written about that, having dominion. Are there other interpretations for that?
Yeah, I've heard, I'm not sure if that's the word that is referred to, that the more accurate translation is management.
Yes, yes.
Rather than dominion.
Yes. A better translation is supposed to be, here's something from a wonderful book on by Mary Lou Van Rossum, Biblical Perspective on Re-inhabiting the Earth, Biblical Perspectives and Co-Spiritual Reflections. Subdue, rada, those of you who had Hebrew, which I hadn't, is used in different settings, the same word. And that, for example, in Psalm 72, it is used in terms of compassionate shepherding. Compassionate shepherding. Now, it is also used in other contexts as to subdue and tread down. So what they're saying is the same word that is sometimes translated as have dominion, or sometimes subdue the earth. You may have read that. That same word in the original could mean like treading and trampling the earth as one, as a farmer would till the soil and stamp down on it to keep the seed from washing out or something. That the image of this word, the original dominion, as compassionate shepherding is found throughout the scriptures. The word is supposed to be used in reference to Noah and the animals in Ezekiel 34. And you see, you'd have to go to a Hebrew text, I mean, to, you know, dig this out. And those of you who have that capacity can dig that out and give you the references. And even in Philippians, which wasn't written in Hebrew originally, I guess. I mean, the reference is the idea of caring for, caring tenderly for, compassionate shepherding is perhaps a better way to translate this than to say subdue, because subdue and have dominion. What is it? The Kipling, what is it? The hymn, you know, by who? God, we have dominion over palm and pine. You know, you think of the British Empire having dominion, you know, sort of controlling everything. And so that controlling idea, compassionate shepherding. Thought of divine. Now, is the divine presence, you see, to what extent is nature itself divine, as it is seen in many, what we used to call pagan, but now we know they are not pagan, early societies that have not heard about Jesus Christ, let's say, is in primitive societies, the divine presence is everywhere. There's a sacred center. In our world today, we are so far removed from the natural world, unless we come to places like Holden, that we do not see those manifestations of the divine. We do not worship the creation. But are we called to worship the Creator by what we see, that kind of attitude? Any questions or comments here? Find a quotation there. The idea that I'm but a pilgrim here, heaven is my home. I mean, there was a period of that, I think, in our religious history, where it really didn't matter what happened to the natural world. Right? Because it wasn't our permanent home. And we know that. I mean, it is not our permanent home. So do we care about what happens to the natural world? Because after all, we're, you know, think of all of our hymns that call us to a citizenship beyond the heavenly kingdom kind of thing.
But we have to leave it for our grandchildren.
That's right.
Yeah. And those who come after.
We have to leave it. I mean, there is a need for to treat the earth gently and kindly. But we also have to allow for development of new ideas and new ways of creation that is going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
In 1856, it's quoted about the Boston, one of the Boston newspapers said that next year we're going to be in the dark because whale oil is being extinguished.
Yeah.
But what new energies have we found since that time that has replaced whale oil? And what new energies are still hidden from us that are...
That's right.
So we don't have to take a sort of a negative attitude that there's not going to be any oil left.
That's right. And I just looked at the Seattle paper because this region would be more sensitive to this issue that, again, in Alaska, do they explore further and dig further for more oil, let's say, in Alaska, which will make a little difference in the pristine environment. You know, should this develop further now? Now that's the same source because we already have Prudhoe Bay and the pipeline and all of that. But to what extent do you go further? What determines how much of the natural environment is altered? And what are there any guidelines for that, you see? That's the kind of...
We were talking yesterday when we went on the hike about some change for the better that has taken place over the last 30 years because I go back 40 or 50 years ago and practically no one was concerned about it. Throwing trash out, you know, right? People just threw trash out of their cars and throw on, a lot of people did.
Mm-hmm.
And industry just poured stuff into the cities, poured effluent into the rivers and so on, and nothing was thought of 50 or 60 years ago. And then it killed Lake Erie for a while. And many, many other places. And there just was apparently no consciousness of it.
That's right.
Until the last quarter century.
Yeah, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, was one of the things that triggered it.
We have the same thing, though, that we're doing to the human body by some of our vices, or so-called vices, by destroying the human body without realizing it, and yet we have neighbor, or within our own country, there are communities that are very heavily destroying their body by smoking and drinking, and we have it also on the personal level.
Yeah. So when I say creation, that is all of us, right? Mm-hmm.
Right.
The idea, Dr. Joseph Sittler, whom you may have known about, Joe Sittler, who was this marvelous Lutheran professor, scholar, writer, I know came to our campus, Texas Lutheran, about 1971, early, speaking about using the analogy of the whole creation is like a spider web. You touch one part of a spider web and the whole thing quivers, if you've ever done that. And I remember Joe Sittler's vivid illustration of that. And so we are part of that. I mean, the human beings, the whole, we're not separate from nature, we're part of it. And the accusation that was made by some of the people was that humankind was put above nature to have dominion of it, over it, in the sense of exploiting it, using it for whatever human beings needed, the anthropocentric, the human-centered view. And I think we're getting away from that a little bit to realize that we're all part of nature, of the natural environment. Now, intellectually, a lot of other things, we would be superior to those chipmunks that run around here, but those chipmunks can do some things I can't. I mean, the way they crawl over rocks and so on. So I guess, how do we relate to the living things, the rest of the living things, the creatures? And of course, how do we relate to the rocks and the water and the minerals and so on? How much of that is tied in with our own lives? That's the kind of thing I'd like to explore in this. There are writers, there are many, many writers who are saying we have lost our sense of being part of the earth, that we as human beings are seeing that we're above it, that we control it, that we've lost our lack of humility before the earth. Did you see Jurassic Park, the movie? If you have never seen Jurassic Park, I recommend it. You may think it's kid stuff. I read the book before the movie came out. It has a very good moral lesson. In Jurassic Park, in the book and also in the movie, is a very skeptical mathematician. You know the story, don't you? That this person with lots of money is, you must have grandchildren or little kids or something, because the little kids know all about this. Keep in touch with the little ones. Anyway, the point is that someone has learned to clone dinosaurs from genetic material found in fossil amber. And so they have successfully cloned dinosaurs, which is not all wild science fiction, because you can read in your magazines that they are finding some life things preserved in amber, and there's some kinds of bacteria that they've gotten out of fossil amber. All right, the point of Jurassic Park is this big entrepreneur who has now developed and supported the development of this process of cloning dinosaurs is building a big theme park on this island off the coast of South America. I think they do it off Ecuador. I'm not sure just where it is. And this will be the big theme park where you have real dinosaurs and see them. And, you know, have a state-of-the-art kind of thing. It's a wonderful movie technologically. Steven Spielberg, I mean, you must see it just from that angle. Okay, Dr. Malcolm is a mathematician who's come to look at this, a very skeptical scientist. And he looks at this whole process where they're expounding the wonders of how all of this is going to work. And they've got their real dinosaurs running around kind of thing. And he says, the lack of humility before nature is astounding. Mm-hmm. Which I think is the key to the movie and the book, in that everything goes awry. Something they had overlooked. They thought they were controlling nature. They knew just how to do it. but they overlooked a couple of things. And so not only do dinosaurs start eating each other, but dinosaurs start clobbering people. And it is quite a story. It has there's a lot of thought in there in terms of a story. When people think they are the dominant ones who can control and shape nature, there are still some more powerful forces there. And I think that's a lesson of how you look at having dominion. People don't. Let's look at Psalm 24. Which I think gives a perspective. Well, someone read verse 1, please.
The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and all those and those who dwell therein.
All right, now that's the key. The earth is the Lord's, right? But now as far as doing something, look at verse 3 and 4. Someone read those, please.
Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false and does not swear deceitfully.
And so on. All right, now that's taking verses out of context. This is an Advent psalm, for example, that comes in here, lift up your heads, O ye gates. It's often read at Advent. But I mean, there's a little clue in there. In case we start thinking too much of human dominion over the earth, subduing the earth is the Lord's. And human beings who attempt to do something with the earth better think about how they might approach that taking over. What causes a lot of our environmental problems?
Human greed,
exploitation of other people for the sake of
money,
whatever kind of thing. Yeah, now not, you know, that isn't the cause of all the problems. Some of the problems have come through ignorance. We didn't know that DDT was bad for anything but bugs. See, I mean, and so later on we find out that these things happen. But again, scripturally, I mean, and we're going to explore some of that later on, many of the problems of environmental degradation are the result of injustice, of exploitation, of human greed. And scripture says that. Only we don't have time to get to that today either. There are biblical perspectives on the creation. Any questions or things you want to raise about this? Just sort of open the can of worms or whatever kind of thing, commentary.
Speaking of opening the can of worms, what about the population explosion?
Yeah, you see. That's the other verse. You see, be fruitful and multiply. Be fruitful and multiply. And of course, I have very good Roman Catholic friends, but most of them don't agree with the Pope on this. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I was in Rome in July of this year, I saw several billboards in Rome which showed a pill and said only one child in Rome. I mean, it said it in Italian, but a friend who could read, that's what it said, which is sort of interesting. But, some of the Sierra comments were on the same subject, that, you know, and every child a wanted child, and how many of our problems are for children who weren't wanted in the first place, but were accidents kind of thing. So, you know, the human problems, compound the problems of the environment, and vice versa. Well, I have a handout, if you would like, which has some references looking ahead, because I know some of you will be doing other things or may have left us, but under the theme of celebrating God's creation, I've tried to summarize some of these things, and if you'd like one, you may. And I appreciate your being here today. We're a little early, kind of thing, whatever. But any further discussion? Anything you want to bring up? Yes.
I thought it was interesting in those Sierra letters that the one you saved for the last and made a hero of was from Texas.
Well, now, that's what you would expect, wouldn't you? Sort of, no. There's some others. So here you go, if you'd like that. Yes.
Here's some textures.
We have spent some, thank you. We have spent so much time in the past, in the history of the church, arguing over literalism of Genesis. I mean, so many battles have been fought over that. When people miss the point, I mean, arguing about days of creation and so on, is anyone still upset about that? Because there are people who are still, I mean, probably not if you come to Holden. I mean, because you hear about these, you know, how can you look at the rocks and you know, millions of years, and I do geology things. I mean, one of my most powerful spiritual moments was at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, where I was doing a geology rafting the trip, holding a piece, sitting among the Vishnu Schist, which is at the bottom of the canyon, which is supposed to be, what, 1.8 billion years old, sitting there, and thinking, my God, how great thou art. I mean, the concept of being stretched in terms of how great God is in terms of anything beyond human comprehension. I mean, geology does that for me and so on. And too often we've looked at Genesis 1 and tried to box God into things we could understand, like Archbishop Usher, what was it, 6004 BC, at what, October 23rd at 9 a.m., the creation, something like that. I had a friend, one of the wife of one of our pastors in my congregation, used the Scofield Bible when she was in confirmation, and it had that in the background. And we have spent so much time in the past in the church fighting that kind of thing and working with, you know, that when we've missed the point, it's just like missing the point of the Job story, you know. Could a whale or a big fish really swallow Jonah? I mean, when that's not the point. And the point of Genesis, it was from a pre-scientific age. The point is not the details. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God. There's a place for human beings. God saw, we read those verses, God saw what? It was good. It was very good. Which seems to have something to do with God's intention. And so as we look at that story, that wonderful story of Genesis, and by the way, Genesis is not that wild, like the earth on the back of an elephant or a ball of mud out of the mouth of a turtle. I mean, you know, I used to do things trying to square the science record with Genesis, and you know, you can fit it in. But I think that's not the important effort to make, to recognize the earth is the Lord's. We are part of all life. Compassionate shepherding of what's here. Okay. Thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you so much.
Oh, well.
I love you.
Thank you. You're sweet. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Let me talk to Evan. I've been doing composting since way before it became a prophet.
Oh, good.
Like the song says, I was country before it was cool. Way back in 1969,
shortly after we moved to Texas,
I started burying our food garbage in the garden. In the vegetable garden, or the flower beds, you know, I just dig some dirt up and throw the garbage in and bury it. Because if it came out of the earth, it should go back to the earth.
Right.
Well, then I got a little bit more sophisticated when we moved to our present house in Hyde Park in Austin. And I dug, I've got two of them, I dug compost pits. I dig a pit in the ground about 4 by 8 and about a foot deep. And I pile the dirt around the edge to make it a little deeper. And we have so many leaves, many trees and leaves that I always felt, I hate to see leaves go to waste, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I throw the leaves in there, and I've got, I have to pile them all up around the yard because I have to, so I can't.
You don't have a magnolia tree, do you?
No.
No.
They're the worst. They're the worst.
We have pecans.
We have pecans. Yeah. And they make good couples. Anyway, then we decided, 24 years ago or whenever, Jenna saves the garbage in milk cartons or other cartons, you know. And I have weekly chores 3 or 4 times a week to bury the garbage. We intentionally did not get a garbage disposal put in our sink because we want to throw the garbage away.
Right.
Well, the upshot of it is I bury the garbage, I bury it systematically in rows in this whole pit, and then I let it cook. And then I go to the other one and bury garbage in there and so forth. And I don't turn it over, I don't do anything else about it. In 4 months, 5 months, depending upon the weather, if there's a lot of rain, it decomposes much faster. And then I get the finest, I wish I could bring a sample, you see.
All right.
But I don't have any here. But I have a huge mound now of cooked compost already.
All right.
And it's brown.
It's so rich. Smells so good.
Smells good. The compost pits never smell bad. You don't get a bad odor from them. I don't bury.
Well, you can't put anything meat.
I don't put meat or bones.
No.
But all other food scraps, including coffee filters and frequently paper napkins and stuff like that, that all decomposes. And people will look at the compost, because a lot of people have come and asked me about my compost. They'll look at that compost and they'll say, that just all came from leaves and garbage? Yes, it did, you know. Well, you look out at the forest here.
Oh, boy, that's what it does.
It does the same thing.
Sure.
Well, Jenna was saying, wondering if I should do a one-period thing on composting.
Backyard composting.
That would be good. Now, we've had that ever so often. And why don't you offer that to John? I mean, because we always have a new group. And, of course, you know, the composting up there. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what they do. But it might be... get somebody from Garbology who really does the composting, and then you work with that person. I mean, you all do a double header, showing how it works in your backyard.
Yeah, because
I mean, how it works at Holderness.
A lot of people feel they can't do it in their yard.
Right.
But you can.
And why don't you suggest that to John for next week and see? Get somebody from Garbology, maybe if there's a good person, how we do it at Holden a little bit, and then how you can do it in your own backyard.
That might be a good
way
to do it.
That would be a good topic.
A dual
kind of thing,
Our daughter, one of our daughters lives on a ranch out by Blanco, and she and her husband manages the ranch. They don't own it. It's a horse ranch. They've got about 35 quarter horses out there. And so they get a lot of horse manure. But then the owners of the ranch are vegetarians. And they want, and our daughter Becky is in charge of the gardening. And she has a couple of workers that do most of the labor now because the gardening has gotten too big for her to do it alone. But she's probably got 2 acres.
Right.
In vegetable gardening. And they make their own compost there. Well, they've got a bin. Oh my goodness. It's about from the wall up to this partition between the doors, about that wide and about this long, filled with leaves, garden waste,
right?
Manure and stuff. and they mix that up and they plow that into this. And when they moved on that ranch, I notice now the soil is so much better now than it was.
That's right. 3 years ago.
When they moved on that. But she would never use any chemicals. And the owners of the ranch would, they don't want anything but organic gardening. Mm-hmm. And she grows the best vegetables, and they've got an orchard and so on. And, well...